Can we talk about go well. How did you and Brian's like deep throated Beru and Owen? How
so
did that
in
start?
In A New Hope, the actress who plays Beru, her voice was dubbed because at one point George Lucas thought it was too low. I don't know what it sounds like, but we always were just sort of thinking like in our heads, like, oh, it's how Uncle if he gets a translated shot speaks botchy. Yeah, it's like Harvey Firestone as Beru.
That would be incredible. I would actually pay for the cut of the movie without
that.
He's too
that,
much of his father.
The deep-throated Beru and like, what's his General Grievous's mother?
Oh, Grievous's space mother?
Telling him to put his space
just put
on.
His space cape on because it's very cold out. And
stop playing with your lightsabers.
It's 0 degrees in space tonight, Grievous. You have that cough, you better put on your cape.
We need more bullshit than this, I'm sorry to say.
Chris, how have you been doing?
Yeah, we're going to talk been. About... We got to talk about why you're not here. I don't want to say anything if you don't want to talk about it, but like...
No, I'm totally cool putting it out there.
We'll have you here on holographic comlink.
We're going to have to translate you from Hatties first.
Yeah, scramble code 5 to the old folks home.
Yeah. There are things in this movie, like the girlfriend and legislative youth program and old folks home, and I'm like, these are two Earth. For me.
I don't know. Have you ever heard of a legislative youth program? Because that sounds pretty alien to me.
It does.
I mean, there's like Boy State and Girl State. That's all
I assume it's
of.
Like Model UN or something. Yeah. Right? Like, yeah, it's like space.
It just sounded
UN.
Too like a thing that we do here.
Yeah.
Debate teams.
I mean, to be fair, also, Naboo seems to be very chill with having like 12-year-olds be their leaders. So like.
So like, what is the youth program?
Yeah. <It's>, like, gotta get them while they're young.
I mean, I don't like coming up with words for things when I'm doing like fantasy world building as much as the next person. But like.
That
you
was
do
crazy.
Need to, you do need to spend time on it. You can just like use any random words you think of.
You should try and come up with a better name into the Star Wars universe for girlfriend than girlfriend.
Ooh, interesting.
Like a sci-fi word for
like
well,
starling.
First of all,
this is my
okay.
Starling. Bro.
Okay, first of all, it can't be gendered because like you've got aliens that don't have clear cut.
Right, so it's just like right, this exactly. Is my bow.
Yeah, yeah. It has to be like bay or bow.
Yeah,
or, like,
bay bow. This is my bay bow.
This is my bay bow. I love
it. I feel like this is Beru, my bay bow. My Beru.
I'm going to start calling people that. Hey, bay bow.
Why did we watch this? The podcast where a bunch of friends sit down with a themed cocktail, watch a troubled movie, discuss what worked, what didn't work, and try to fix it. I am Brendan, the lesser Drishler.
I am Obi-Wan Kenobi, Delahanty. Shit.
Do you want to do it again?
No, I'm going to let that stay.
Okay.
I'm going to let it go.
I'm Chris. I hate Sand Ravel.
This is Brendan Dexter Jetster Nystead.
Thank you for joining us yet again, Brendan.
Sounds like a
thank you for having
character.
Me.
What'd you say, Lee?
It sounds like a Jetsons character.
It really does.
You guys have jets right in the yeah. Movie. Yeah. As you can probably tell by our nicknames, today we watched Star Wars Episode II, Attack of the Clones, the movie that many, myself included, consider to be the most troubled of all the Star Wars movies. And
I agree with that.
Yeah, and we will get into that in a moment. And first, we will start off with the drink that we made today. The drink is called a Tatooine Sunrise. It was one part mezcal, one part cherry hearing, one part sweet vermouth, and one part orange juice. And I was the only one who really had the full drink.
Lee yeah,
had.
I think it's worth noting at this point that Chris is with us remotely this week.
Yeah, Chris is, we have our little hologram on the table and we can see Chris yeah. Here.
I am recovering from breaking my leg pretty badly. And so this is coming to you live from my bed.
Ooh.
How provocative.
It's sultry.
Might this be the most sensual episode? Why did we watch this? I hope so.
Live from Chris's boudoir.
Oh, boy.
But yeah, that's why my voice might sound a little different. Clearer, even.
Yeah. Anyhow, so only two of us have really actually had the drink. Lee, what did you think? Just to have.
I just sounded awful by the description of it. And then I basically told Brendan not to make me one, and I would just have a sip of it. And I did, and I was done with it. It didn't, like, my one note on it is that it didn't taste as bad as it smelled to me.
That's always a good thing.
Yeah.
I would have used less mezcal next time, but
did
aside from that.
Did we say the
that,
ingredients yet?
Yeah, I did.
Okay. Yeah, I think it's, none of the ingredients are things that I drink. So therefore, my review of this drink should not have any bearing whether or not it is a good tasting drink. It's a drink made of, like, the things that I hate.
Well, let me say, dear listener, when you're feeling a little low, try a shot of cherry hearing, sure to perk you right up.
Is that really what it says on the bottle?
No, that's what I'm saying to you right now.
He's doing a plug right now. He's
yes.
Trying to get that,
I'm
that,
trying to get
sweet,
that sweet,
sweet,
Come on, guys.
Because you know all of the money that Big Hearing has.
The Swedes are rolling in it.
The cherry liqueur industry.
So I thought the drink was pretty good, as I said, aside from the Orisa Mezcal. It's basically a blood and sand, which I like a lot. But having covered that, as much as we can cover it with only really one and a half of us drinking it right now, I guess we will go on to the plot, which I will recap from our dear friend Wikipedia. I imagine most people have seen Attack of the Clones because you are human, but let's give it to you anyway. So 10 years after the Trade Federation's invasion of Naboo, the Galactic Republic is threatened by a separatist movement organized by former Jedi Master Count Dooku. Senator Padme Amidala comes to Coruscant to vote on a motion to create an army to assist the Jedi against this threat. Narrowly avoiding an assassination attempt upon arrival, she is placed under the protection of Jedi Knight Obi-Wan Kenobi and his apprentice Anakin Skywalker. The two Jedi thwart a second attempt on her life and subdue the assassin, Zem Wessel, a shapeshifter who is soon killed by her bounty hunter client before she can reveal his identity. The Jedi Council assigns Obi-Wan to identify and capture the bounty hunter, while Anakin is assigned to escort Padme back to Naboo, where the pair develop a romantic attraction toward each other. Obi-Wan's investigation leads him to the remote ocean planet Kamino, where he discovers an army of clones is being produced for the Republic, with bounty hunter Jango Fett serving as the genetic template. Obi-Wan deduces Jango to be the bounty hunter he is seeking and follows him and his clone son Boba to the desert planet Geonosis via homing beacon placed aboard their ship. Meanwhile, Anakin becomes troubled by premonitions of his mother Shmi in pain and travels to Tatooine with Padme to save her. They meet Owen Lars, Anakin's stepbrother and the son of Shmi's new husband, Kleeg Lars. Kleeg tells Anakin that Shmi was abducted by Tusken Raiders weeks earlier and is likely dead. Determined to find her, Anakin ventures out and finds Shmi at the Tusken campsite where she dies in Anakin's arms. Enraged, Anakin massacres the Tusken Raiders and returns to the Lars homestead with Shmi's body. After revealing his deed to Padme, Anakin says that he wants to prevent death. On Geonosis, Obi-Wan discovers a separatist gathering led by Count Dooku, whom Obi-Wan learns had authorized Padme's assassination and is developing a battle droid army with the Trade Federation Viceroy Nute Gunray. Obi-Wan transmits his findings to Anakin to relay to the Jedi Council, but is captured mid-transmission. With knowledge of the droid army, Supreme Chancellor Palpatine is voted emergency powers to send the clones into battle. Anakin and Padme journey to Geonosis to rescue Obi-Wan, but are also captured. The three are sentenced to death, but are eventually saved by a battalion of Jedi and clone troopers led by Mace Windu and Yoda. Jango Fett is killed by Mace during the rescue. As the clone and droid armies battle, Obi-Wan and Anakin intercept Dooku, and the three engage in a lightsaber battle. Dooku overpowers Obi-Wan and Anakin, severing the latter's arm, but Yoda arrives and duels the Count. Finding he is unable to defeat Yoda, Dooku flees to Coruscant, where he delivers blueprints for a super weapon to his Sith master, Darth Sidious. As the Jedi gravely acknowledge the beginning of the Clone Wars, Anakin is fitted with a robotic arm and secretly marries Padme on Naboo with C-3PO and R2-D2 as their witnesses. The end.
Skimmed over some stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, it was nicely concise. The way that it's written there makes that army thing seem 100 times crazier.
How so?
Where just that sentence of like, Obi-Wan goes to a planet where he discovers there is an army being made for the Republic. That just sounds like an insane thing. Nobody discovers that an army has been being made for 10 years.
In all fairness, the title of this film is Attack of the Clones.
But like,
clones in the title, no, but like, as advertised.
Obi-Wan does not know that he is in a film called Attack of the Clones.
Oh, I'm sure he does. He looked at the script.
Obi-Wan has a lot of powers, Lee. You really can't underestimate a Jedi.
He has a deep insight.
He is a Jedi master at this point in the game, let it be said.
To me, that just comes across as bad writing. That we're just like, well, we need this to be the case right now. So it's going to be the secret project that always was.
So there is a lot of examples of, may we say, bad writing going on in this movie. We have a couple of different discussion topics that we wanted to go over. The first thing, I think the most obvious thing that people tend to talk about is the romance between Anakin and Padme. So let's talk on this for a little bit.
I have a first question to bring us into this.
Answer.
Did anyone think this was romantic? Did you ever hear anyone in your lives talking about like, oh, Anakin and Padme? Like, did you ever hear that?
Yes.
From the internet or from real
life? From the internet. Tumblr, definitely. That's one where you have to read a lot of stuff into it. It didn't exist back then, but I've heard of people talking
about it. Oh, you mean like at the time, like back in 2002?
I'm saying like these people come out of...
Yeah.
Because I feel like over time, it would have made... Like, I don't buy it over time because we sort of go back on it now and we accept that the movie is trash. But I feel like you can be duped into thinking that it's not trash at the time when you see a movie because it's like you don't want it to be and it can't be. And like you haven't had time to process it and listen to everyone else talk about how bad it is.
Totally.
So I kind of want to know, like, did anyone come out of this?
I'm sorry. So when you ask anyone, are you saying like, did we specifically know someone?
Do you ever remember like, if you think back to that time, do you remember like classmates or like anyone in your or like internet message boards as they were back then being like putting like pictures of them with hearts around them and shit, like whatever.
It had to have happened.
I'm sure sure someone did.
12-year-olds and 13-year-olds are real dumb.
Yeah.
It's just hard for me to wrap my head around just because I don't think I've ever seen a couple on screen with less chemistry.
I mean, I feel like the interesting thing to say also here, like just sort of in general about this movie, is I feel like at the time when this came out, people were saying it had improved upon The Phantom mm-hmm. Menace in a lot of ways. And I will agree that in some ways it does improve upon The Phantom Menace, but in the sense of like a fairly linear plot with characters with like pretty clear motivations, it does not at all improve upon that. Like there are issues with The Phantom Menace, 100% to be sure, but this movie seems to have learned all the wrong lessons from The Phantom Menace. And I think a big example of that is the romance in this. To me, it feels like George Lucas watched The Empire Strikes Back and was like, okay, so for people to fall in love, they should fight a lot and they should be stranded by themselves in space. And then at the end of the movie, everyone will accept that they love each other. And to me, it mostly just feels like Anakin is a creep who wants Padme and she wants nothing to do with him.
All right, here's what drives me so crazy about this relationship. Because I think the movie offers this up as if it's, we know that they're going to get together, so the movie just doesn't bother to like do any work to actually develop them as a couple. So we get these scenes of them bickering about stuff I don't care about, and then having conversations about stakes that they never elaborate upon. Like, they can't be together because I'm a senator and you're a Jedi. Great. Feel free to spell it out for the audience why that's an issue, or why that's an issue for the story.
I don't know. I feel like they spell the stakes out, but I mean, this is part of the world building thing that I want to get to later, but I think the stakes are like terribly ill-wrought and ill-conceived and not thought through. But the big problem I have with it is that it doesn't, I think it's partly the acting and partly the writing. I guess it's written to be a romance, but it looks like Amidala. I mean, I'm sorry. I don't know. I just can't think
of that. That's her last name. Padme Amidala. Her state name is Amidala.
I don't think about Star Wars, guys. Yeah.
She was an elected queen. Like, yeah. It's a crazy system.
Let's not pretend it doesn't make sense.
But Padme, like, I know she's like 5 years older. Uh-huh. Than him, but she may as well be like 20 years older.
Oh, he still reads like he's a 9-year-old.
Yeah, he talks like a grumpy little kid.
He's petulant.
Talks like an adult.
Well, she talks like an adult talking to a child. Yeah. Like a kid says something, you're just like, that's a nice thing you said right there. And then you like hope the kid will stop talking, but he keeps saying things.
I want to think that a little bit of that interaction is intentional because he is supposed to be like a little stunted. He's missing something from his life since he was taken away from his mother in the previous film.
Yeah.
But it still is not. It doesn't make him an appealing character or a character that is easy, at least for an adult, to identify with.
No. Well, like I said, I think there are better ways. Anakin seems too cocky and he feels like he's ready for the trials. And I'm like, I asked you guys to tell me, like, is he like overdue for them? And you were told me like you didn't think he was. I was like, but if he was, that would make more of a reason why he's upset about it. But because it's like not even time for him to be at that stage yet, it just sounds like a whiny kid being like, come on, coach. Like,
he sounds like a weirdly like a privileged little kid because he was told from a child, like, you're the chosen one, you're special, and you're gonna be the best Jedi ever. And so like naturally he grows up to be like this whiny adult who's like, why isn't everything going my way much faster?
It's Obi-Wan's fault. Yeah.
If you look at it structurally, how their relationship is put together, if you look at it scene by scene, there's not much to it. Like, their conversations aren't substantive. They don't say anything interesting about the characters or about how they're relating to each other. And then it's just sort of by the end of the movie, we're supposed to be like, oh, they're together. Of course. This is a great love story.
Well, that's part of the burden that this movie carries as a prequel, right? And Lucas wasn't Cage. Padme is the mother of Luke and Leia. And so everybody went into this movie knowing that this romance had to happen.
But then actually, like, make it happen.
Okay, no, totally. But, yeah, an excuse, but that is something, like, the a priori knowledge does affect the way you watch this movie.
Right.
I also think that if they had just put in any work into developing their relationship or chemistry on screen, this would not be a problem at all.
I think also there's another sort of overarching issue with the entire prequels is that George Lucas never really seemed to know a whole lot about who Darth Vader's wife / Luke and Leia's mother was. Like, he knew that she existed because obviously she had to exist, but he never really, I think, knew until going back and writing The Phantom Menace who this person would be. And I think there's a pretty big reason why Padme is sidelined through a lot of Revenge of the Sith, because like George Lucas really just did not have that strong of an idea going in as to like what would happen necessarily to their mother. Like, how would, like, obviously she's not in the picture, so she died. How did she die? And I think the fact that like she's sort of an afterthought comes across pretty strongly in the prequel.
I think he was like, well, we have this place where we have to end up. We're going to go through the motions of the steps to get there. And everyone already knows what that destination is, so who the fuck cares? But I think what it ends up resulting in is moments later in the movie that should have a lot of emotional weight and resonance, but they don't. There's that shot of Padme and Anakin being kind of like their hands are being parted and it's like their silhouettes against this like very bright opening. And it's a very nice, simple image, which is a rarity enough in this movie, but it has no meaning because their relationship has no meaning and these characters have no meaning.
Here's the thing. I feel like we talked a lot about like the relationship, but I feel like we're not getting to the problems with this relationship.
Yeah.
Problem number one. You cannot have a crush on a girl from when you were 9 years old. Yeah, that's creepy.
That's weird.
You meet someone and you are surprised to find that like what you once admired as a mother figure is now like a hot lady to you. You do that. You can do the bickery thing if you want, or you can pick another romantic angle. But if you do the bickery thing, then like you probably meet her and like maybe you think she's pretty at first, but then she has different opinions than you because she knows that you're still a Padawan and she treats you like one, not like. And then you can go through that, and then eventually like. One of Anakin's ideas is actually better than Padme's ideas, and then you sort of like they work together and blah blah blah. Like there are like any number of arcs that work. It's just that number one, George Lucas doesn't understand what love is or how to write it. And number two, I don't know what is going on with Anakin's actor, whose name I
can't say correctly.
I was gonna say like Christian Hayson.
Yeah, close.
I don't know what's going on with him, but like he for sure cannot act in this movie.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it there's fault to be laid on the actor, and there's a lot of fault to be laid on the writing, and I think there's a lot of fault to be laid on George Lucas as a director.
Yeah.
Like he has a screenwriting credit and a directing credit on all the prequels. When he has talked previously about how like he is not good at dialogue and he does not like directing people, so it's like why are you doing it then? And I think it really shows that like he is not an actor's director. Like if you don't know what to do in a scene, you're not going to get the help from him. Like if you're not sure how to read the dialogue, his response will be, well, just say the dialogue.
Did
like,
he want the control of the prequels, or was he forced to do
it? My honest to God thought for the prequels is that he felt a sense of obligation to do them, but he also didn't want someone else to do them. He wanted to get them done because people expected to someday do them.
Yeah,
but he didn't want to hand it off to someone else and be like, here, have fun.
Do you think with The Force Awakens, do you think he like, I better hand this off to someone?
Well, I mean, Disney
had already bought the company at that point.
Yeah.
Yes.
And he never wanted to do, I mean, he wanted to do 12 and then he wanted to do 9. And then after like Revenge of the Sith, he was like, and we're done. So like effectively speaking, had Disney not gotten Lucasfilm, there could have never been an episode 7 and it would have stopped right there.
But he would never have been offered the thing, do you think? Because I mean, Disney is a smart company, so they probably wouldn't have offered it to him.
Well, he wrote a treatment.
Yeah.
He wrote a treatment for 7 that Disney did not use, or at least did not use in full.
Yeah.
We're not really, no one knows what the treatment was really about, so we can't say.
But I don't think that, like, yeah. I think that, like, that may have been fine. I think that, like, you just don't want George Lucas to be, like, everything.
And, like, there are things he's very good at. Like, he's very good at creating, like, a general story, and he's a good detail man, but he's not good when it comes to, like, getting into, like, these very specific things, like dialogue and directing.
Like, everyone comes across as very wooden and robotic in this movie, and it's not just the acting. They're kind of murky as characters. They're not very well fleshed out.
I think that George Lucas thinks this is a specific type of romance. Like he's talked about how he believes this is something akin to like Gone with the Wind or something.
Kind of an old-fashioned
movie. And like, yeah, and you could also sort of look at it in the sense of like Guinevere and Arthur or Lancelot, in the sense of like Lancelot.
I'd agree with that. The Corley love thing I buy. And there is that like class delineation between Padme and Anakin that he tries to make work. But I think that it's mostly a failure in execution.
Yeah, I don't think George Lucas was basically like, oh, no one cares about the romance here. I think he was really just like, he thought that this was exactly what the romance should have been.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, was that George Lucas in the room? I could have sworn I just heard.
Hi, Chris. It's me, George Lucas.
Oh, my God. Hi, George.
I digitally replaced you with a bantha.
Did you?
Okay. I'm going to cut this short because
I got to go.
Is this a good segue into world building?
Yeah.
This whole notion of this is the love story he wanted to tell and he wanted it to be like they can't be together.
Mm-hmm.
I have a huge problem with that world building thing of Jedi cannot be in a relationship.
All right. Yeah. Let's swing into world building and go off that.
So that's my first world building problem, that like it wasn't in episode 1 and no one's ever talked about
it
before.
It wasn't mentioned.
It wasn't mentioned. That's the thing.
They've always been like warrior monks, right?
Yeah. It's not explicitly stated in The Phantom Menace. So.
But it does not seem like a thing that would be in the worldview of like Jedi, which are supposed to be like the Catholic Church. But like,
First
of all, the IRL reason that priests can't marry is so that property can't be divided between sons.
Yeah,
it's a pretty stupid idea to think that like, oh, if you just like decide not to have sex, like you will have no problems from that. Yeah. You're a sexual creature.
You and God will be A-okay.
Yeah, I think that Jedi would be like a wiser institution to understand that like when you're supposed to be like really zen and chill all the time, that it's going to be really hard to do that. that if you're not allowed to love people, which is something you also teach that you should do.
Yeah, that's I totally see that. But also, I think one of the themes of these three prequel movies is that the Jedi, it's an old order, and they're bad. They suck now. All this dogma has weighed them down. And when they are called to action, when they need to step it up, they can't because they have all this baggage.
I think also that's a lot that goes to sort of an overall theme of this movie about like telling, don't showing, where like we know that the Jedi are tied up in dogma because they say that they are. Mm-hmm. And we know that like their ability to use the Force is diminished because at one point Mace Windu says
this whole movie is tell and not show.
Right.
So like the theme of the Jedi's being outdated, that was news to me. I was like, oh yeah, I guess. I had to do a lot of work.
Again, they plant like the seeds. Like when Obi-Wan's talking to the librarian, he's like, where's this planet? And she's like, must not exist. And he's like, no, I'm sure it's there. She's like, nope, sure doesn't. It's supposed to indicate that the Jedi are so convinced of their own abilities that like, if it's not there, surely it just must not be there. It comes across, I think, as very dumb in this movie. Like the same thing happens whenever Obi-Wan and Yoda ask the child for his thoughts as to how the planet could have been deleted from the system. And the child says, the child says someone probably deleted it. How dig this is. It's supposed to, I think, come across as this idea as a child is still able to think outside the box and be like, well, someone surely just did it. But it makes them seem like a bunch of idiots who did not consider like the simplest explanation, like Occam's razor, Obi-Wan.
Yeah, you got to remember that Lucas is not subtle at all.
Yeah.
And he literally put the Jedi in an ivory tower. Like, they're completely disconnected from the rest of the galaxy.
Very true. Very true.
I feel like I've seen a movement nowadays to try to look back a lot more fondly on the prequels. And I feel like these kind of arguments are used where they're like, well, here are all these themes that you missed. And I also want to say, I didn't miss those themes because I'm an idiot. I missed those themes because this movie was bad at communicating them.
No, I totally agree. And that is, you know, it is very, very difficult for me to engage with this material in a way that ignores all of the material surrounds it, especially the Clone Wars series, the animated show. I think that really brought a lot to this movie.
To be fair, I think the people that are talking about like, well, here are all the themes that you missed, I think they're sort of doing what we do here at YWatch. They're sort of saying like, I mean, yeah, there are things that we're trying to be communicated in this movie, but they're just not, they don't have the caveat of like, but it utterly failed to do it.
Right.
But like, I think we will also talk about like in the latter half, like, there was an attempt at some storytelling here.
And there are things
that you could have been, that you could have done something with.
Yeah. I generally like the prequels while acknowledging a lot of the problems that they have. And there are things in this movie that I like that I think are good. Like the action sequences I think are generally pretty good. I think some of the minor characters work well. I think Ewan McGregor is good, but it is hard to sort of like to take them as a whole, I think. When he started Phantom Menace of like what he wanted to cover from like 1 to 3, but he had not really broken down like what each movie was going to cover and gone into detail. So like you can watch the three movies and be like, I see where this overall story is going of like, say, how Anakin is going from like baby to Sith Lord.
Mm-hmm.
It's when you get tied down in these details of like, well, how did the war start? Who is Padme? Like, how did Palpatine rise to power? That it sort of becomes fuzzier and kind of like, it's something that he sort of came up with on the spot for that movie without a thought of necessarily working it into something prior.
It makes it just feel like they were just rushing through the beats instead of trying to develop them meaningfully.
Well, here's the thing is that I think in the weeks prior to seeing this movie again and like doing this episode, I think at one point Brendan and I, I think we're talking just about the prequels versus the original movies and how it was sort of destined to not be as exciting as the original movies because the original movies start in a very dark place where it's like a war and you're like you're underdogs. And now the prequels have to do basically like the lead into World War One. The prequel movies have to be like a political powder keg before all the bad shit happens. Mm-hmm. And that's just not as exciting as like one where people are dying in trenches.
And it's also like Star Wars being like a war, like then you go back to this thing where it's like, oh, this war is simmering and starting now.
Yeah,
like it's less fascinating to sit there and be like, okay, who did what, like why did they assassinate Archduke Ferdinand? Like it's not a fascinating
like the space taxes like the Trade Federation and all that nonsense.
And again I'm not saying if you don't like the prequels it's because you don't find politics fascinating and you're a bad person, but to be fair, like they were coming at the prequels come from a much harder place, like you said.
Yeah
that's a really good point.
I also think the politics are very poorly explained.
I agree with you in the sense of the fact that I don't understand how the system of government works at all, but I like space politics. Like I'm weirdly intrigued by the idea of like basically like all these stupid petty squabbles going on between these space senators. Like it's sort of entertaining to me.
Me too, but it just seems like in the script they just kind of wrote like space politics, space politics, space politics.
No, I think George Lucas again is very like sophomoric in his attempt at it.
I think he just has like a very simplistic view of what a political system.
Yeah.
And that's what this is.
I have a world building question that kind of plays into the political system.
Ask it.
So we get, I would argue, a bunch of, if not outright antagonists, but like antagonistic forces, because it's not just Dooku and it's not just the Trade Federation. There is also that little like council, like Legion of Doom style.
The separatists.
Yeah, yeah. They were just like a cabal, basically.
Can someone just explain to me what their fucking goal was?
I think I can, and I don't... Can I do it? Can
yeah,
I,
go try. I want to hear what you have to say. Yeah, try it.
So the separatists are... I think they're like economic. They're not necessarily senators, but they're like the leaders of business. And they don't like the rules that the Republic puts upon them. So they're a group that is trying to destroy the Republic.
Effectively, yeah. It's like we said also, it's sort of like an Atlas Shrugged kind of thing.
Yeah.
Where it's like all these business people being like, our interests are not being adequately represented in this form of government. Ergo, like, we must declare war on you.
Yeah, that is one thing that I find like kind of disturbing. Disturbingly prescient about the Star Wars prequels is that these corporations also have representation in the Senate as if they are like, sovereign systems.
Yeah.
Like that's really terrifying to me. That's kind of the world we're living in right now.
Yeah.
I know. It did have like weird owners to watch it this day and age.
Yeah, no, it is. Like
all the healthcare companies that don't want public health insurance. I'm
And I think there is like an interesting story to be told in that like all these corporate interests rose up and were like, we've had it up to here with the restrictions you're putting on us, and therefore like we're going to do what we can just to like break off and like govern our own destinies. It's like if Standard Oil just declared war in the United States, like it's kind of a neat idea.
I just feel like that, and I agree, it's a really neat idea, applicable to now kind of idea.
Oh, good. Discussion over.
But no, I was just so confused on that point. At least from my perspective, a lot of who they are and what they want is buried under a lot of interminable yada yada that happens.
Well, they say like whenever they're going, everyone goes around, this is like what they represent and how much they love Count Dooku.
It's not a good scene.
No, it's not like a great way of introducing everyone, but like I do think you get the implication that these aren't planets, these are corporate interests who are all like, yeah, like we're all for what you're doing. And again, a lot of the politics of it are not well served. Mm-hmm. I don't know a whole lot about what this treaty is that they want to do. I don't know what their end goals are.
The treaty was confusing. Count Dooku's place in the world was also confusing to me because I think... I think he comes. I know that you think, oh, he's a count or whatever. He's just a political idealist. What the fuck does that mean? And how does that dismiss him from suspicion?
Well, I think they say in the beginning that he's a former Jedi so that he won't kill people.
Right.
Like,
and he's a political idealist, not a murderer.
Yeah.
And so, like, again, you could use this as an indication as to, like, the Jedi are a bunch of idiots and that they think, oh, well, surely a Jedi wouldn't kill someone else. And he was a Jedi, ergo, cross him off the, like, the suspect list.
I just thought that was, like, really weak.
Well, this is an anecdote before my story, but I think I said in the beginning of the movie where you guys were talking about it, that's because I was like, did they say talk about him in episode one? And you're like, no. And I was like, well, that's fucking stupid. You can't just walk into a movie and be like, I think this man tried to kill me. And like, we don't even know who this guy is.
No, I agree with you. They do a very bad job of introducing Count Dooku in the sense that like Padme says, I think it was him. We never see him until like the last third of the movie.
I feel like that's kind of fallout from killing Darth Maul in the last movie. They wanted two bad guys, one behind the scenes, one kind of in the forefront. You got to come up with a brand new guy.
I mean, the prequels, to be fair, so full of like dispensable bad guys.
Yeah.
Too. Like,
General Grievous in the third one.
You have Dooku, even though he shows up in the third movie, he's dispatched like within the first 15 minutes. And Darth Maul in the first one. Because like, do you remember, like, you remember people like fucking losing their mind over Darth Maul when we first saw his picture? Mm-hmm. Like, and to be fair, like, he's a really cool looking creature. Like, he has a really neat look to him. Then we found out that like, he had two lines of dialogue and he died because he stood still for too long.
Yeah.
And I do think that this is again sort of indication that George Lucas did not have a really good overview of what he was doing, because I think if he had, there would have been more connective tissue with like the secondary villains in these movies. Because really the only one you get is Nute Gunray. Like, God bless him. If you had told me watching The Phantom Menace, like, you know who the villain is who's going to show up the most aside from Darth Sidious? Nute Gunray. I'd have been like, fuck you.
But it was just like, why do we don't Nute Gunray anymore? And it's just like, from when I was watching this, I forgot he was in it just because I forgot a lot of things about this movie. But it was like... Oh, so like, what was the meeting here? They're like, well, we bring back a villain from the first movie. Okay, cool. Let's pick the crazy racist caricature that we used as the main antagonist.
But like, there's all full of racist caricatures.
Yeah, Watto.
Like, you got Watto back. You got Jar Jar back.
That's very, very true.
All right, but I do have a Count Dooku story.
Yeah.
Which is like, when we were watching this and they got to Geonosia?
Geonosis.
And they got to Geonosis and like, this is my like a transcript of the conversation. I think I was like, who... lives on Geonosis? And you said Geonosians. And I said, okay, where is Count Dooku a count on? And then you said like some other
Serena.
And yeah. I said like, okay. And the tone of my voice was like, that means nothing to me, but I have no energy to like follow through on that.
Like, it's also like the movie never, I mean, I guess he's there to oversee the weapons.
Maybe. Well, he's like the leading member of the Separatists. And like, that's where all the Separatists are hanging out. They're chilling on Geonosis. Ergo, Dooku is. To go off of something else, we're talking about world building. Lee, you mentioned wanting to go into the clone army.
Yeah, I do. I want to go into it a lot.
Okay.
I'm going to start with a compliment. It's going to be a compliment sandwich.
Yeah.
I do like about this whole movie is how it starts with two groups that have no army.
Uh-huh.
And I like the idea that because the Jedi are like the UN and the Republic is a big, happy coalition government, there is no one has standing armies because they're a massive democracy and they feel like they don't need them.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very realistic place, I think, to start a movie from. Therefore, I like that the Separatists have been building a droid army because they want to fuck shit up. But then there's this fact that, like, if they were to go to war, the Republic has no army, and that's a big plot in this movie. And then halfway through the movie, Obi-Wan goes to some other planet because he's chasing after a bounty hunter. And I think the Wikipedia article just says, like, while he's there, he finds an army is being made for the Republic that no one knows about and was like ordered by 10 years ago by a Jedi on the order of the Republic.
Right.
And I don't know if there's a record of it because nobody fucking checks.
Right. So there's a lot of issues with the whole getting to the clone army and making of the clone army. Getting to the clone army, we get there because Obi-Wan finds a dart that Jango shot at another bounty. Like, also incidentally, apropos of nothing, it really bugs me like how like micromanage this entire assassination attempt on Padme is, where it's like Dooku hires Jango, hires Sam Wessel, hires a robot, hires two centipedes to kill Padme. And it's like,
I want this Russian nesting.
No, I know. It's like, God, just fucking shoot her. But anyhow, so they
say though, that sequence had one of my favorite shots. The like slatted shades with that crazy neon light coming in, and it was like cast over Padme's bed. What a beautiful, simple image. I hope we get more of these. Nope.
So they find out about Kamino because Jango Fett shoots a bounty hunter with a dart that has Kamino markings on it. Obi-Wan goes to a 19... Sorry. Oh,
no, I said it's a souvenir.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. When in Kamino.
Is that where they get... I mean, that's nuts. I just remember they go to the diner.
Right. Obi-Wan goes to a 1950s diner, yeah. Hands it to the proprietor. The proprietor says, oh, this is Kamino. It's a place I've been to. They're cloners. Obi-Wan goes there. They all are like, oh, hey, Jedi, you're supposed to be here 10 years ago, but we're glad you finally showed. And he's like, I guess that's why I'm here. So, but also, Dooku erased Kamino from the archives. But why did he erase them from the archives? Like, he wants to lead the Republic to the army, that he would have left in the archives and not made this such a like fucking like workaround for Obi-Wan. I don't know what anyone's motivation is in trying to get them to this army.
Yeah, okay, here's the thing. Nobody knows why this army was made in this movie. And I think he said it was like, it's explained in various ways through books and stuff,
right.
Like in this movie it's unclear if the army was made on a good order or a bad order, except that it is definitely a bad order because there definitely is programming in them that kicks in the third movie where they kill all the Jedi.
Yeah, right.
So that is definitely some bad people ordered it, but we don't know that yet.
It was ordered by Master Sifo Dyas, who, when I first saw this movie, when they said Sifo Dyas, my initial thought, like as a what, like a 15 year old, was like, oh, that's Sidious using a fake name. But then Obi-Wan's like, oh, you mean the Jedi Master who was on the Jedi Council, Sifo Dyas? Yes, and I was like, wait, what now? And then he talks to Yoda Mace, like, oh, Sifo Dyas, that guy who's been dead. Yeah, of course we know him. What, like, so it wasn't placed by Sifo Dyas. It was placed by a Jedi Master. We don't know what the Jedi Master was doing. We don't know who he was ordering it for. Was he ordering it, like, because he was friends with Dooku? Was he ordering it because he genuinely thought that one day the Republic would need an army, and so he decided to, like, go off his own zone and do it? Like, we have no idea.
They do a little bit of work with that in the Clone Wars show, but... clearly here, like in this one movie, it doesn't give you the pieces that you need to put the whole thing together.
Which is
even episode 3 doesn't.
Right, and then they don't mention it all in episode 3.
All right, this is not a thing about
Star Wars movies, though, where they want you to have to dig into supplementary material to find these answers, when I think it should be incumbent upon the movie to give you this information.
And that was never really an issue until the prequels, to be fair. Like, the books previously were kind of more like, do you want to hear more about the adventures that Luke Skywalker had? Here he and Leia went to this swamp planet, met some furry people, and found an evil crystal that Darth Vader also wants. Have fun. But like here, it's like, do you want to know who ordered the clone army? Read this book.
Here's the thing that definitely is not ever on the books because it wouldn't make any sense. But like, I had this brief crazy thought that like Sifo Dyas could have been Sidious before he became evil. That like there's a world where like Sifo Dyas assumed a false identity as a sender, and that like obviously now that I'm remembering, he is on like Naboo in the first movie.
Right. Yeah.
That doesn't make any sense at all. But, like, that could have been a thing.
Yeah.
But there was a real Jedi Master a long, long time ago who, like, ordered an army.
Yeah, and then he, like, takes his own death.
Yeah, and it was like, part of this, like, massive long con. Yeah.
That's close to my understanding of the way that they've kind of retroactively explained it through other materials.
Yeah.
Where Sifo-Dyas was a Jedi Master, he left the Jedi, and then he wanted to have an army, and the Jedi said, nuh-uh. He went to the cloners after he left the Jedi, ordered the clone army, and then I guess that Sidious and Tyrannus at that point, aka Count Dooku, had him killed and then took over the army from him, or he was under the influence of Palpatine / Sidious, and it's just like super convoluted.
So it was either a good person ordered the army and then said, like, by the way, can you program them to like randomly do this thing if I tell them to, or it was always bad,
right? Because that is also like one of the biggest things I'm left wondering at the end of this movie is who placed this order and were they doing it for ostensibly good reasons or ostensibly bad reasons.
The problem is being that if it was a bad reason, then you do want them to find the army,
right?
But then if you don't. Because then you could have had a droid army and no opposition to it.
I know. I'm really wondering, like,
they really stacked the deck against themselves.
Right, because then whenever they're on Geonosis attacking, Nuke Gunray is like, the Jedi have amassed a huge army, and Count Dooku is like, oh, where would they find such a thing? And like, the clones that you know about, because your bounty hunter is the template for them. Are you playing dumb, or like, do you really know? Like, who knows what in this movie?
I guess Count Dooku should have said more clearly as a line, like, how did they find my army?
Yeah, or just say nothing at all. Like, he could have just said nothing, and you would have been like, oh, he knows, it's okay. And like, he's playing both sides against each other.
Yeah, that is the thing that you need to remember, is that like, Palpatine is the one in the middle playing both sides. He controls both sides. And so, like, there is some sort of a rivalry. And I think the weird thing about this movie is that the Separatists are totally right. And Count Dooku, in that one scene where he talks to Obi-Wan, is telling 100% the truth. Dude, there's all these planets that are actually being controlled by a Sith Lord. There's this guy named Darth Sidious. There's all this stuff going on behind the scenes. And Obi-Wan's like, no, you're a liar.
Well, there's that. I'm sorry, I have to go back to it because, like, when we first watched this movie again, Count Dooku tries to tell Obi-Wan, like, oh, there's a Sith Lord on the thing. And Obi-Wan just immediately dismisses it. And you're like, but shouldn't you maybe like tell, hey, this is what Dooku said, maybe we should look into it? Because like, at this point, Count Dooku has not revealed himself to be like a crazy evil villain. Mm-hmm. He's just said, like, I am a lost, like, I'm an ex-Jedi, and I have the best interest of the Empire, of the Republic at heart, and I'm telling you that there's a Sith Lord on the council.
Mm-hmm.
Like, huge if true.
Yeah. This
is something you should maybe look into.
Which is weird. Like, what's his MO in telling Obi-Wan this too? Because like, why does he want Obi-Wan to know about the evil plans that are really going on here?
Then Yoda says later on, like, oh, this is his method. He's trying to sow distrust.
Yeah, he says like lies are his way now or something like that. It's clear that Yoda doesn't quite believe him, even though Mace Windu says like, we should keep an eye on things.
Yeah, but I mean, like, honestly, that's the moment where Mace Windu is the smartest Jedi in the fucking
world. Yeah.
You should fucking
look into
that.
That's why he's the leader of the council, apparently.
Is he really?
Yeah.
Always?
Yeah.
Oh, Jesus.
AAF, baby.
AAF.
The other thing to segue into it following the Clone Army would be the visuals of this movie. Visuals in whatever way you want to take it.
Can I just start on a happy note?
Sure. Be happy.
Okay, so I'm going to do a very typical Chris thing and talk about
Padme's dresses.
Oh, my God. All right.
We're going to go get a drink. You just keep talking.
Okay, it's not going to be that long, I promise.
Go ahead. To speak.
No, it went silent, so I wasn't sure.
No, we were just waiting.
He was getting his notes.
He's putting the PowerPoint together.
Obviously, I didn't really care for the performance, but her dresses were fantastic. There were some headpieces that I was really partial to. I really liked that whole kind of like semi-medieval getup that she has in the field when she's listening to Anakin's terrible sand monologue. It was just like a lot of just really cool space rich lady looks that I was feeling. I was loving the clothes. I also wanted to put a shout out in the kind of like end battle scene when that's just starting up and there's like a pretty decent handful of Jedi that are just kind of like dropping into the Coliseum and they're all kind of like striking their individual poses and whatnot, and you can kind of get a hint of their own like fighting styles and looks. I thought they all looked fantastic. I actually found that to be one of the most exciting parts of the movie, because it's at least a glimpse at like a wider, more interesting palette. Particularly, I love the green woman in what looks sort of like a brown, weird, askance nun's habit. I thought she looked fabulous.
Is that Barisafi?
Probably.
Yes, Barisafi. She looked amazing.
Can I offer a counterpoint to the first segment of your...
Yeah.
I hate everything Padme wears. Fucking hate her. I think I called them all her terrible space sundresses.
I like her costumes. I think there's a lot to like costume wise in these movies. Like if you like nothing else in this movie, I feel like you can generally like if you're a Star Wars fan, you can generally walk away being like, well, this is a cool outfit that I could someday cosplay as.
I like Jedi robes a lot.
And if you're the future Roger Bart, as I am, that just loves a ridiculous woman in ridiculous clothes, there's a lot for you here.
Yeah, I think that one thing that all the three of the prequels do is their visual design, maybe not the execution, the visual design shows this very opulent side of the galaxy, but that by the time, you know, you're exploring kind of the rebellion and the corners of the galaxy that aren't so nice in the original trilogy, all of that chrome-plated, really opulent texture is completely been stripped away by this dull gray boxy empire.
Yeah.
I hate the space diner too. It's not the space isn't like the 50s.
See, I agree. I like Dexter Jetster for some reason. Like I think he's a goofy character, but like there's something weirdly appealing. Like he like reminds you of, like it is, I think, a good way to do like a space version of the sort of guy you would see in a diner.
I'm fine with the chef.
Like, I do agree with you, though, that the aesthetic of it is too much just, like, diner in space. Like, I think that's...
Did what? Anyone watch Reboot when they were younger?
Oh, God.
Oh, yeah. No, I totally hear that.
Much like the diner from Reboot.
I don't know. I feel like it's Lucas, like, riffing on American Graffiti a little bit, Mel's Drive-In. And I think that's okay. It's a little, you know, it's a little callback for him.
No, thank you.
I don't want that in Star Wars. Goodbye.
I think he just didn't go far enough on this. Like, I feel like the cantina feels like something in Tatooine, you know? Like, it feels like it is something that could only exist in Tatooine. Like the architecture and, like, the shadowy things and, like, the weird the little hovels that everyone has to sit in. Mm-hmm. This feels almost like a diner, but 15% outer spacey. And so, like, that is the issue I kind of
that's my problem. It's the ratio. And it's not, like, it's a thing that's clearly built for humans. Mm. Like, it's not, like... It doesn't
it's mostly
look like
Johnny Rockets.
Yeah, it pretty much is like Johnny Rockets.
Well, that would have been such a better nature gesture too, Johnny Rockets.
It doesn't look like a thing that is built for many, many different species of shapes and sizes.
Well, now you're getting into the Zootopia argument. Yeah, that's here lies madness.
I guess, but my first and foremost problem is that if it's something that I could see on Earth, I don't want it to be in Star Wars because Star Wars is not where Earth is and it doesn't make sense to me. It's cognitive dissonance.
I think honestly, like even a point of comparison would be the nightclub that they go to in this movie, mm-hmm. where it's like the nightclub like feels like an alien nightclub.
The nightclub was cool as shit. I wanted to go there so badly.
You sit there with Katie Lucas and Anthony Daniels and
Ahmed Best,
yeah. All your favorite Star Wars behind the scenes people.
Those are all the people I want to hang out with in my free time.
Oh, cool. Can I talk about some of the critters in this movie?
But
I got to give mad props to Poggle the Lesser, who's the leader of the Geonosians. I love his aesthetic. I love that like weird little like brooch on his chest plate. And I love that his language is like kind of has that clicky sound to it. And it's weird. He has those weird tendrils coming off of his chin. I also really love the Aklay, which is the big like mantis-y
crab.
Scyther.
I also really like the Nexu, which is kind of the cat creature in the arena. The Reek, who's like kind of like the bull looking guy. I don't know. I've never really liked him.
I think he's just a little too like it's not quite as crazy as the other ones. The Nexu has like crazy quills and it's like white and pink.
It has a
prong tail and like the Aklay is just such a weird like spidery crab thing. Mm-hmm. But the Reek is just kind of it's like a rhino with some bull. It does its point well and I think it looks neat. It's just not quite as crazy as the other ones.
The Aklay also. I think I said this when we were watching it, that like when they all come out and each of the three beasts get one of the three people, they're like appropriately like leveled for the type of person who's actually dealing with it. And appropriately the Aklay is just this like fucking monster that like a skull appears over it when you're in a video game. It's like, do not fuck with this thing yet. You're not ready for this.
So the Colosseum scene is actually something I want to kind of use as a springboard to get into a gripe I have about the visuals, mm-hmm. which is the over-reliance upon green screen, which can lead to very inorganic looking action. So I did watch a special feature on this because that was on the DVD that my roommates have. And there was a thing about how they show you like some shots of them shooting the Colosseum scene, like on a soundstage with all the green screen, not even an overturned chariot was built as an actual prop. Well, there's no way we could possibly build one. Let's just animate it.
Well, I have seen countless behind-the-scenes footage of Star Wars prequels movies where it's just, like, a people on a square with, like, a stick. I feel like this was a time in movies where like we were like, this is just how we do things now. Like,
I don't know if anybody was ever like, well, this is a foregone conclusion, this is the way things are going to be. But Lucas, for what it's worth, has always been willing to like push things really far. And I think that this movie, more than any of the other prequels, this film was shot completely digitally. They were dumping footage directly to hard drives and they could watch dailies like minutes after they shot them, which was revolutionary at the time, especially because you were seeing the footage one-to-one. You were looking at the exact same footage that you just captured, which now you think, oh, I can do it with my iPhone, who cares? But 2001, when they were shooting this, like, that was amazing. There is a lot of green screen. There is a lot of CGI in this movie, but I feel like somebody had to make all of these mistakes and try all this stuff so that we could learn from it.
Right, and it is, like, Attack of the Clones is weirdly emblematic of, like, Lucas as a filmmaker always pushing things for good and for bad. Mm-hmm. You get the good in the sense that, like, there are a lot of things that worked well and that we learned, and you get the bad in the sense that there are a lot of things that look very dated and, like, you know, yeah, like, the textures. Yeah, there's a lot of, like, textures that don't look too great. There's a lot of lighting that looks a little off. You get both at the end of the day. And I think that George Lucas, for whatever reason, doesn't quite get sometimes the difference between like the practical and the digital effects sometimes, mm-hmm. because he's been on the record talking about how people have said that like, oh, well, why did you do like CGI X in the prequels? Like, it's so fake. And his response is like, well, so was Jabba the Hutt. Jabba the Hutt was fake too. And I don't think he quite gets what the argument is being made there. Like, because yes, Jabba the Hutt is fake, but there is a physical thing there. And like, you get frustrated with the fact that Jabba the Hutt is a big stationary puppet.
Yeah.
You might want to get something more out of it, and I get that, but at the end of the day, it's a thing.
I mean, that was the thing that was such a breath of fresh air in Force Awakens. I mean, for as much CGI was admittedly in that, the things that they did practical effects and actual props for was so refreshing.
To Chris's point about the acting being affected by it, do you think that back then people hadn't like gotten the hang of acting?
Oh, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
Like, absolutely. I don't know what I'm
like. I think like Liam Neeson had said, like, what a confusing experience Phantom Menace was for him.
Yeah.
Because like, just like who had done this sort of thing before?
Yeah.
Like, well, you see that X over there on the wall, that's what you're in for. It's like, yeah. you're scared of the X. You're confused by the X. And that's why you have, a lot more like stand-ins. And, you know, I think that that's why things have maybe gone in maybe more of a motion capture direction. So yeah. you have someone physically there to interact with in the space.
Yeah. So I'm sure that like that's become a thing that's evolved over time. And it was very new back then to be like acting on a blank stage with like a square and a stick and being like, you're fighting with a lightsaber and there's many, many lasers around you.
It sounds like the argument is being made that we had to do this first to realize we had to do it a different way.
Or we had to, you know, at the very least, we had to do this first so that we could do this a lot better.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, I'm not saying to do it a different way. I'm saying, like, I think a lot of movies now still get made like this. I think there are still scenes in movies today that we just can't. I'm sorry, like, Pandora doesn't exist. We have to make a CGI planet.
My dreams.
But, like, I think we understand better how to help actors put themselves in that world more when all they really are doing is standing on a green screen.
Yeah, the fact of the matter is, I think that we've just gotten, like, way better at hiding where the CG is.
Mm-hmm.
I was at Star Wars Celebration last week in Orlando, and I saw a panel where they talked about the making of Rogue One. And I was shocked to see that a lot of the cockpits of the spaceships in the movie were completely flat planes that were just white when they filmed it. And they digitally added all the control panels onto them later on. And you don't see that. It just is completely seamless at this point.
Slick.
So, you know, Attack of the Clones had to do that to break the ground so that you could seamlessly put in, you know, minor alterations or even like full sets in the background.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And wouldn't it be nice if like some shit movie done that beforehand so that Attack of the Clones
admittedly, yeah.
better. But like, but then again, it had to be someone going to have a lot of money. And
right.
Have
it's, yeah. yeah it's someone so who like wants to push this sort of thing. And like whatever you issues again, you may have George Lucas. He has always wanted to push this sort of thing. That's like his MO. At times it almost feels like the entire prequel trilogy was made because he wanted to see like what he could do. With
it was, a lot of investment in R&D for ILM. That's for sure.
On that note, the last thing I want to talk about here is going into the prequels in general, how they might connect to each other, how they were sort of conceived, that sort of thing. The starting point I kind of have is just, I think because Attack of the Clones is such a weak movie, it makes both Phantom Menace and Revenge of the Sith worse movies in comparison, because it is the connective tissue that is supposed to like tie one to the other. And I think because it is working with those two, it does no favors to Revenge of the Sith, and it retroactively does not help any problems you might have had with Phantom Menace.
It also just does, it's does a terrible job of transitioning you from one to the other.
The way that I tend to read this movie is that I think that Lucas and Brendan can totally disagree with me on this, because I think that we both have different ideas of maybe how Luke developed the stories. I think that episode one to me says that he didn't know what to put in this space, and so he just like went all out crazy with a bunch of stuff And like it sets up a few pieces of the story, but 2 and 3, because he kind of put off the really important pieces, 2 and 3 had to have way more than they should have. Whereas episode 1 could have set things up in a much more effective way. And I think 2 suffers from that. We were talking about that. Like, is the plot of episode 2 overly complicated, or is it too simple and dumb? It's kind of in the middle because it needs to convey a lot of information to you so that you can understand what happens next. But it also feels like you're being spoon-fed every single little piece of information that he needs to communicate to you. It doesn't make you work for anything.
It's almost like there's like a checklist of things that we need to cover in the Star Wars prequels. And I feel like half of that checklist got crammed into this movie easily.
Yeah.
And like, I agree with you, though, for the record, like 100%. Phantom Menace, like there are people who say that you can basically skip Phantom Menace in terms of watching the Star Wars movies and you will not miss much. I don't quite agree with that.
Yeah, I don't agree with
that
either.
But I do think that because it is such a weird self-contained little story for the most part, that it doesn't do a good job of starting the prequel trilogy. And
but
I think
will never miss pod racing. I'll always watch Phantom Menace.
Yeah, and spinning is a good trick. But I think putting more of the aspects of the start of the Clone Wars in Phantom Menace would have been a better thing.
Yeah.
Like just sort of alluding to that a little bit more. Like I kind of like in theory the idea that Phantom Menace is like a very sort of like goofy, dumb, happy kids movie, and then everything starts going badly after that.
Yeah, it's a more innocent age, right?
Yeah. But I also
maybe it should have been like the first Harry Potter movie where this little kid finds out that he gets to be a cool knight.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, and I think that also sort of talks to another issue though about the Phantom Menace, and that there's not very much a clear protagonist in that movie.
No.
Because I feel like if you were to tell me like George Lucas is doing the prequel trilogies, can you guess what the first movie would be about? I would probably say, well, maybe Anakin or maybe Obi-Wan. And the answer is, well, usually Qui-Gon and sometimes Obi-Wan, and you get a little bit of Anakin in there too. And so it's like there's not really one person you're following. And the person you follow
but
the most
dies. But you also get Amidala.
Yeah, but I wouldn't call her the protagonist, though.
If we're divvying up in terms of how much plot they each get, I think it puts her up there.
No, that's not how we're divvying it up.
I think to do than Leia does in the first Star Wars movie, certainly, because Leia really doesn't get to do anything until like Luke and Han rescue her for the most part. But I don't know if she's that big of a protagonist per se.
I feel like it's in the beginning, it's like Qui-Gon is on a mission, so he's the one we're supposed to be following through
right.
this mission. But then he gets separated and Obi-Wan's by himself.
Right, yeah. There's a long period of time where Qui-Gon is with Anakin and Padme, and Obi-Wan's just on a ship, like sitting there.
Mm-hmm.
Like he's not doing anything.
And then you meet Anakin, and Anakin has his own objective.
Pod racing thing.
Yeah.
And then you go back to Qui-Gon. It's just like there is a lot of bouncing around in that movie from like one to the other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I realized watching this movie again that, and we'll talk about this more in our fixes, but I feel like this movie might be more effective with less Anakin and having his romance with Padme be a little bit more on the margins and having this movie be Obi-Wan's movie more. I know that you need to get to know Anakin so that when he falls as Darth Vader, it's more tragic, but I just couldn't help but think that like a cooler like mystery for Obi-Wan would be a more interesting A story, whereas it's kind of split in half between Anakin and Obi-Wan, and they both kind of get equal screen time for when you're seeing what each of the characters is doing.
Honestly, like one of the issues though I have with this, and we had mentioned this, Anakin and Obi-Wan have very little screen time together throughout this movie.
Mm-hmm.
They don't interact like one-on-one at all in Phantom Menace. Qui-Gon's like, hey, Obi-Wan, this is Anakin. They're like, how you doing? And that's about all you get between them. And then in this movie, Anakin's a different actor. He's much older. And you start off immediately with being like, hey, they've had adventures together and they're friends and this is his master and he's a Padawan. And then they split up almost immediately after that and don't get reunited until the end.
Yeah.
And so like you are told by Obi-Wan in A New Hope that like Anakin was like his good friend and like he loved him so much. But like you don't see any of that in the prequels up until Revenge of the Sith, where you get a little bit of it before he turns all out evil.
Yeah. And Anakin really spends a lot of time in Attack of the Clones just like completely dissing Obi-Wan.
Yeah.
He's really rude.
What a rude boy.
Are we ready to talk about fixes?
Well, do we want to go into
All
right, we'll cover Looking to Score real quick and then we'll go into fixes here. Of all the Star Wars soundtracks, of all the John Williams soundtracks far, I think Attack of the Clones is simultaneously the weakest soundtrack of the 7. The droid factory sequence was something that was thrown in very, very late in the game. It was entirely green screen. Jango Fett CGI, the C-3PO is CGI. No one is real there except for Anakin and Padme. And I think because this was something they were working on up until like the last minute, John Williams' score kind of suffers this time around. There are some very good themes that like. I like Across the Stars, which is the romance theme between Anakin and Padme. I think that's a very good romantic, but kind of like a doomed romance kind of theme. I like some of the other smaller things he does with a sequence with Zam Wessel. And honestly, apart from that, there's not a whole lot that really leaps out at me. Like, he wrote an entire piece of music for the factory sequence, none of which was actually used in the movie, where they were just taking like temp tracks, snippets of like pre-existing music already in the movie and splicing it together for it.
Oof,
and,
really?
Yeah. And like, if you, I think it was like there was a Best Buy version of the soundtrack or something that had it as a bonus track. And it's a weirder music. It's a little less, I think, dramatic than the one that's in the movie. It's a little more sort of like mechanical and like percussive and plotting, which I kind of like better. But it really does feel like John Williams was kind of like working on this until the last minute. And as such, it did not turn out perhaps as well as it could have potentially. Like, I think it also says something that I was listening to the final track of Attack of the Clones, where it's like final sequence music with the Imperial March and the wedding, and then the end credits. And the end credits theme is either entirely or almost entirely Across the Stars, which almost to me feels like it's there because there were no other dominant themes in the movie and there was very little else for him to work with.
Good contributions to the Star Wars musical canon. But yeah, really, it kills me how much they reuse cues in this movie. Oh, they're all over the place.
Like the clone, when they use the Droid Federation music for the clone army.
Yeah, which I've heard explained in a way that's like, that made sense.
I think it's kind of like, because they're effectively the same thing. Like,
yeah, they're
like
connecting this clone army to the mechanical army. Like, right. And John Williams is kind of telling you, this is the same thing.
Right.
Like, I still feel like that's, I don't know, it doesn't.
It's not the best comparison I've ever heard.
Yeah. I think that the use of the Imperial March is interesting towards the end of the movie.
I like it at the end.
Yeah, it's kind of a more regal version of the Imperial March.
No, I think honestly, like, one of the scenes that really works for me, I think, is like the last sequence right after Yoda has begun the Clone War has.
Yeah.
And they just show like the senators like on this little platform and all the clone troopers being led off into like the proto Star Destroyers and everything like that. And I think it's kind of like a really good sort of gut punch at the end of the movie.
Yeah.
So I give credit to John Williams for that part.
Yeah, definitely. I think that, as always, you know, John Williams adds to most scenes, even the scenes that aren't so great.
The one scene where the music really, I just misses it, is after Anakin does his sand monologue and he's touching Padme on the back and they kiss and the Across the Stars theme swells and Padme says no, and it drops out almost suddenly. Like, there might as well be a scratch in that sequence. I get what he was doing, but it comes off as almost comical in how abrupt it just all of a sudden is. Like, I'm sorry, you were saying something.
Oh, no, it's fine. Okay. And that's a very good point. Yeah,
we should segue into fixes. Does anyone want to start us off?
Yeah, I haven't thought it through at all. Here's what I think should have happened at some point in the sequel, the prequel, so I don't think it ever happened, is that Anakin should have been a likable character. And I think if there was a movie in the three to show that he was like a cool guy at one point, then it was this movie. And he was a terrible person in this movie. He was like a whiny, annoying babby. And I think for like maybe the first 20 minutes of Revenge of the Sith, is that what the next one is called? He is kind of cool and badass. He's like, I just remember like they open on a battle and they're like, oh, like look, Obi-Wan and Anakin are like fighting. And it's just like they said, where they were really good pilots and they fought together. Then he also kills kids in that movie. So like, he
kills younglings in
that
movie.
Yeah, that's true. There are no kids in Star Wars. But yeah, I think I needed a movie where we felt for the downfall of Anakin by showing as like he could have been great. So I feel like Anakin should have been a really promising person that maybe had some troubles. And the troubles, again, could have stemmed properly from him being taken into training at a young age. So I guess making his struggle in this movie less of him being a fucking privilege, like a white privileged whiny babby Jedi, and being more about like other Jedi who are younger than him being ahead because he was taken in at a later age. And even though he's like a prodigy, obviously doesn't have like the same wisdom and like sort of zen that other people have. So I guess the biggest fixes I'd make in very broad strokes is that Anakin would be very likable and competent, but like a little impulsive and like emotional. And I think the emotional thing should come from a good place. Like, he can't stand the injustice, but instead of like taking the time to think about whether he should intervene, just doing the interventions. Again, I think I talked about my romance fixes in depth earlier about like, it's creepy that he had been dreaming about her for 9 years. That's creepy as hell. You were 9 years old and that's really creepy. And just making that, like, again, making the romance more natural in general and human. And the army, I just like, I need to know why that army was being made. I needed the Jedi. I can't stand that the Jedi and the Republic are like fine with it and they don't bother to look into it because it is what kills them in the third movie. Mm-hmm. So like, it's on you. It's on you that you didn't maybe investigate what where this army came from.
Chris, do you want to go?
Yeah, sure. It's interesting that Lee would end her fix on the army because that's where I think I'm going to start. So the way I'm envisioning my fix is, I mean, we're going to keep a lot of the action, but in my opinion, I want this to be more of a like a political thriller. And I think a good place to start is maybe the accidental discovery of Kamino and the army. Then it can be a mystery of figuring out who created it, why, and also a bit of kind of like a race to see who's going to like claim it first. Maybe make it an item of interest to the Separatists so that they can have it. And if so, the Republic won't, they can like crush them more easily. I also think that would be a much more natural way to kind of fold nation attempts in that way. Like maybe Padme is kind of like leading this investigation or is a very vocal voice in trying to figure out, you know, what's going on here, that Dooku tries to have her killed a few times. I think that can be scattered throughout the movie. I think it would also give a way to better explain the villains and what they want and why they want it. This would lead to a less emotional story being told, I think, just in terms of the romance between Anakin and Padme and the kind of like the friendship that Obi-Wan and Anakin have. But I think you could still devote like a handful of key scenes to those to kind of just get that across very simply. And that could just be, you know, like B and C plot to the larger, you know, on the brink of war political thriller A plot that I have in mind. I think you could get a lot of the character motivations you want a lot clearer within my fix, as well as kind of better establish the place of the Jedi within the system, the place that Anakin and Padme and Obi-Wan all kind of have within it, because I think those points are very, very murky, and they only are kind of clarified as the plot demands immediately. My fix is focusing more on kind of world building and maybe shifting it off less character-driven things, more plot-driven things, especially if your director doesn't like directing people and can't handle dialogue.
Brandon?
Okay, I have a few thoughts. I feel like one problem that this movie has is that it spends too much time in the Senate, in rooms discussing, you know, how the Jedi can't fight a war. I think that the movie should start with the Jedi already starting to fight a war for the Republic. I think that they should be more beleaguered. They start off the film seeming to be like sitting pretty, just as they were in episode one. And I think that, as I mentioned earlier, I would expand the Obi-Wan storyline and push Anakin's storyline to the margins a little bit. The more you keep Anakin and Padme's romance a secret from the audience, perhaps the more it feels like it's also a secret to Obi-Wan, and that would be another betrayal of Anakin's faith to the Jedi Order and Obi-Wan. Yeah, I think that the Jedi need to be feeling the hurt at this point. The Separatists need to have a real groundswell for the political situation to feel like it's legitimate, because they spend a lot of time talking about how the Separatists are a thing, but you don't really see that in action. So I think that I would also definitely do a better job at explaining in Obi-Wan's kind of detective subplot. It would be, and my version would be kind of like Blade Runner-ish style story, where he's having to go, you know, into the lower levels of Coruscant, kind of like what we see. We get a little tiny taste of it, but it just feels like it's not enough. And he needs to be going and doing a lot more. It's too linear the way that it is right now, where it's like, oh, Kamino Saber Dart, I need to go ask somebody that knows about Kamino. Go to Dexter Jester, go to the Jedi Archive. Like it's very like boring the way that it is right now. And so you need to pepper that intrigue in there. And I think that they waste all of that way too early on with Sam Wessel and Jango Fett killing Sam Wessel. And I think that I would want to see a scene in here. I don't know if this is like my Star Wars ring theory brain kicking in, but I would love to see a scene in here akin to the scene in Cloud City in Empire Strikes Back, where Lando brings everybody in to a long table in a white room and Darth Vader's at the other end. I would want to see Obi-Wan sitting down to eat with Jango Fett in a white room at a long table and having a very drawn out discussion where Obi-Wan's trying to suss out details about the clone army and Sifo Dyas and what this means. And I think the rest of the movie could more or less stay the same. I think that the whole arena scene is a little overblown. And I think that the clone army battle is also way too long. But yeah, those are the ideas that spring to mind immediately for me.
So I have this whole thing written up that I did Friday night after work.
Excellent.
So just to sort of kick this off, what I think this movie should be, it's a movie about people making horrible decisions and fucking up and not being at peace with the force of the galaxy. In this movie, Anakin should be unfailingly good. Like how you have this kid in the first movie who is just like the best, sweetest little kid in the world. He doesn't need to say spinning's a good trick or yippee or things like that. But like, I want him to like not be as overtly evil as he comes off in this movie. The dramatic irony comes from this very, very good person being done in by his love for other people, not by a guy who is good, but also kind of a creepy, petulant jerk. Also, the thing about Jedi not being allowed to love is gone. This is not a mandate. Their relationship has to be one-sided because it just can't look like it's him being into it. So this is my plot story treatment for Star Wars Episode II, The Clone Wars, because Attack of the Clones is the worst name ever. Padme and her security team land on Coruscant. Her ship is destroyed by a hidden explosive planted on the platform, but she was secretly piloting an Naboo starfighter while one of her handmaidens slash bodyguards was impersonating her. The handmaiden dies, and Padme immediately rushes to the Senate to weigh in on the Republic needing an army in the wake of dissatisfied Outer Rim worlds and corporate interests. Chancellor Palpatine is clearly relieved to see her alive, and they discuss the threats made on her life. Padme believes it's possible the attacks are being carried out on behalf of someone in the Senate, possibly a senator in favor of raising an army like the hawkish Orn Frita, while Palpatine conjectures that it's someone from the separatist movement. He suggests involving the Jedi, perhaps Obi-Wan and Anakin. Padme refuses Palpatine's offer and enters a lift with her delegation members and security team. The lift suddenly stops and the doors open on a darkened floor. As Padme and her team exit, they are attacked by three shadowy men who make short work of her security team when Anakin and Obi-Wan suddenly arrive, lightsabers drawn. During the fight, the illumination of the blaze reveals one jarring fact. The three assassins are all completely identical. The Jedi are surprisingly evenly matched by the trio, almost as if they had been trained to specifically combat a Force user. The attackers manage to escape into the night. Anakin and Padme have a brief mutual moment of recognition, and Obi-Wan reveals that Palpatine had actually arranged for them to protect her earlier. He was acting without any approval from her. Anakin and Padme plan their protection strategy as Obi-Wan goes to the Jedi archives to research cloning. The head of the archives informs him it is simply not done. The Jedi have no record of it, and if the Jedi and all their wisdom and generations of studying don't, then it doesn't exist. Obi-Wan consults with Yoda, and the two have a brief discussion about the nature of the Force. The Jedi are noticing that it is being clouded by something, presumably the Sith Lord who trained Darth Maul. Yoda says they must continue to rely on the Force and trust in their own judgment. If they can't, what's the good of the Order? The Council is also suffering from the loss of Qui-Gon. Without him, there's been less opposition to some of the more conservative members of the Council and an increased focus on strict interpretation of the Jedi way. Obi-Wan decides to go to Sereno to visit Count Dooku, Qui-Gon's master, who left the Jedi Order because of their constricting dogma. Obi-Wan admires Dooku in a way because of his rebellious streak was similar to Qui-Gon, and how he was always less enamored with the Jedi Council and more in tune with acting through the Force itself. Dooku also indicates that in his journeys, he has encountered an unknown planet called Kamino, where the native population holds science in a high regard. It's rumored that they have pioneered advanced cloning technologies beyond what the Republic is capable of and can create life. Dooku provides Obi-Wan with the coordinates, and the young Jedi leaves. With Obi-Wan continuing the investigation, he charges Anakin to keep Padme safe. The pair and R2-D2 travel anonymously across the galaxy, but unbeknownst to them, they are followed by the bounty hunter Jango Fett. After Jango attacks the pair of them at a layover point, Anakin, Padme, and R2 flee and manage to lose Fett in an asteroid field. They make an immediate choice to quietly sneak back to a remote location in Naboo. Anakin suggests a small lakeside village where his mother Shmi now resides with C-3PO. As a way of thanking Anakin for his services to them, Naboo bought and freed Shmi from Watto and provided her with a home. Padme is slightly wary of the isolated locale, but Anakin has not seen his mother in years, so she agrees. At Shmi's homestead, Anakin and Padme reflect on their mutual feelings for each other, heightened by the danger of escaping Jango Fett. Obi-Wan lands on the watery planet of Kamino and meets the Prime Minister Lamassu, who proudly shows off their cloning facilities. The Prime Minister also indicates to him that an army has been made for the Republic and is now ready for usage. Obi-Wan asks who authorized this creation. According to the records, it was Qui-Gon Jinn. Lamassu also indicates that while their facilities are far more advanced than anything the galaxy has seen, they can replicate human life, they have accelerated growth techniques, and so on. They have only ever used one human as a template, the bounty hunter Jango Fett, who resides on Geonosis. Obi-Wan is also suspicious that the clones who attempted to kill Amidala were the same genetic template as the army before him. Lamassu says the Kaminoans prize scientific progress above politics. If an investor wished to obtain a few clones, they don't care what the reasoning is. Obi-Wan contacts Mace and Yoda, who are shocked that this could happen without their knowing. Was Qui-Gon right to make this request? Did he foresee something the other Jedi could not? Would it be right or safe to use this army? Why would the assassin use clones, knowing it would lead them right to this army? Yoda and Mace decide to meditate on this as Obi-Wan returns to Anakin and Padme. On Naboo, Jango Fett has managed to track down Anakin and Padme. Late at night, he sneaks into their home, holds Shmi hostage, and offers to exchange her for Padme. Anakin desperately tries to rescue his mother, but Jango Fett fires his blaster at her. Before Anakin can react, Obi-Wan enters and duels the bounty hunter. Jango manages to escape via his his jetpack, but the damage is done. Smee dies in Anakin's arms. Anakin blames himself for not saving her sooner, for indirectly leaving Jango to Shmi, for letting his mother die. Obi-Wan says he is aware of who the bounty hunter is and where he is based. The three make choice to journey to Geonosis with 3PO and R2 in tow to further unravel these plots. On Geonosis, the three split up. Obi-Wan trails a group of high-ranking separatists, including Nute Gunray and General Grievous, and Padme and Anakin find a factory making an army of droids for the separatists. Padme immediately contacts the Senate through her ship's communicator and tells them the Republic has no choice but to use the clone army provided for them. The anxious Senate agrees with Padme, and Palpatine is granted emergency powers. Obi-Wan is captured by Geonosian security and taken to the mastermind behind the separatists, Count Dooku. Obi-Wan is shocked and betrayed, but Dooku states that the Jedi's over-reliance on their dogma is leading to their own destruction. If Force-sensitive users wish to experience true enlightenment, it must be on their own terms. The Jedi have become their own worst enemy, Dooku says, and Qui-Gon knew this would happen someday as well. Obi-Wan deduces that Dooku contacted the Kaminoans using Qui-Gon's name, and Dooku confirms this, and then informs him that he too has felt the Force being obscured, and he believes the Republic is already infiltrated by a Sith Lord. Obi-Wan refuses to acknowledge this, and Dooku says he has no choice but to execute him. Padme and Anakin, meanwhile, are ambushed by a group of Geonosians and battle droids, and chase them to the droid foundry. The two are split up during the chase. Anakin is pinned down by a soldered piece of metal on his arm, and Padme is being pursued by Jango Fett. Anakin makes a frantic decision. He can't lose her too. He cuts off his own arm with his lightsaber to come to Padme's rescue. The separatists surround the pair and Dooku enters. They are captured. Anakin and Padme confess their love for each other, where they are led to the arena with Obi-Wan, where the three are going to be executed by alien beasts. They dispatch the creatures, and Dooku sends Jango to finish them off. Just as he is about to, Mace enters with a squad of Jedi. In the ensuing battle, Anakin faces off against Jango and is about to strike him down when Mace inserts himself into the duel and dispatches Jango. Mace warns Anakin to be careful of his anger, and Anakin acknowledges this. The Jedi seem to be outnumbered, but the clone army led by clone commander Boba arrives at the last moment, launching an epic battle sequence. The Separatists retreat, and the Republic forces give chase, attempting to round up the higher-ranking members. In the battle, Padme flies her craft with R2 and 3PO in tow, targeting droids from the air, while Obi-Wan attacks on the ground with Mace. During the fight, Obi-Wan force-crushes General Grievous's chest, dispatching the cyborg general. Anakin spies Count Dooku leaving and attempts to stop him. Dooku makes an appeal to him. Didn't he always trust in Qui-Gon, a more skeptical master? When Anakin refuses to see Dooku's perspective, Dooku reveals that he was accountable for sending the three clones and Jango after them, and indirectly killing Shmi. The two duel. Anakin holds his own surprisingly well for having only one arm, but Dooku hits him with Force lightning, revealing he is now a Sith Lord. Suddenly, the action stops. Yoda enters. Dooku engages with the Jedi Master and tries to hit him with Force lightning. Yoda reflects and absorbs the deadly bolts. Dooku charges at him, but Yoda knocks him back with a percussive wave of energy. Dooku draws his lightsaber, but Yoda meditates. His green lightsaber activates, levitating, and attacks Dooku head-on as Yoda focuses on the Force. Dooku engages the flying lightsaber as Yoda hurls objects at his former Padawan. Realizing he is lost, Dooku uses the Force to make the ceiling come crashing down on the two and escapes in his ship. Yoda's lightsaber falls as he focuses his powers on protecting himself and Anakin. He levels the entire hangar in one blast of energy, throwing the debris to the sides. Obi-Wan, Mace, and Padme enter, the two lovers embrace tightly. Back on Coruscant, Dooku meets his Sith master, Darth Sidious, who congratulates him on provoking the war. In the Jedi Council chambers, Yoda reflects on how his heightened Force abilities away from Coruscant is no coincidence. He must admit that Dooku might be telling the truth, and the Jedi must be wary of the government. Mace believes they must stand with the Jedi beliefs and traditions. They have held fast to them for generations and will need them now more than ever. Obi-Wan, meanwhile, reluctantly accepts a position as a general with the Republic Army from Bail Organa on behalf of Palpatine in recognition of his bravery in battle. The clone army is dispatched to the far reaches of the galaxy. In a small chapel in Coruscant, Anakin and Padme exchange marriage vows as starships fly to war in the distance. The end.
Wow.
Cool.
Wow. Stuff.
Thank you.
That was well done.
Thanks.
Would you recommend to watch this movie?
No.
I mean, have you like not already seen this movie?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, yeah. This is a weird one to ask the question because you're going to see it. Like, if you're going to like get through Star Wars, you're probably going to make a decision to watch all the Star Wars movies. And if you like Star Wars, you're probably going to see it even if you don't like it.
Yeah.
But no, I think like, I wouldn't recommend it in terms of like, I literally said I don't like this movie. I don't have fun watching this movie. Like, I could rewatch The Force Awakens again, and I could rewatch 4 to 6 again. I don't think I ever want to rewatch the prequels again. I think
yeah,
I just want to like catch myself up on what happened in them via Wikipedia or some other more expedient means of spending my time.
Lee and I are on the absolute same page.
I feel like I would have a weak recommend in the sense that like, if you don't like it, you're not going to like it by watching it again. Like mm-hmm. You're not going to see something really in it that you didn't see the first time. There are segments that work well. Most of the action sequences work pretty well, but if it's not your thing, it's certainly not going to be your thing. So unless you really like Star Wars, I'm not sure that there's a whole lot you'll get from this.
Yeah. One thing that I have to say is that if you take this and you know, this is a total cheat, but if you watch the four plus scenes that they did of the Clone Wars show, a lot of the work that they do in there goes a long way to bolster the limitations of this movie. Things that they skim over or that they don't give you that's necessary information, like, is elaborated on pretty well in The Clone Wars. And I think that this plus The Clone Wars leads up to episode 3 in a much more interesting way. It makes Anakin Skywalker a much more complete, interesting character. So that I would highly recommend that if you're in the themes of this show, that like The Clone Wars cartoon does it way better.
That's a good point, actually. As always, the website is www.dratpack, more ostensibly on Twitter, but don't bother. And we are at facebook.com/whywatchpodcast, which we're a little bit better about. Until then, we will see you guys in 2 weeks with a mini episode, and we'll get back into the game at that point. Ready to bite out, guys?
Yeah, I have to count it down because Chris won't see hand signals.
What about the lag?
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. All right. Bye.
Bye. Bye.